Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. While we still have a long way to go when it comes to expanding the ranks of women in the film industry, I have had the honor and privilege through Conversations with Creative Women to meet and share the professional, personal stories of more than a handful of directors, producers, writers, and editors. Today's guest is part of that important, impactful, groundbreaking group. Talia Toubon is an award-winning documentary film and television director, producer, and writer whose projects focus on contemporary social and political issues and have aired on HBO, PBS, the BBC, network television, as well as the History, Discovery, and National Geographic channels. Talia, whose work has taken her to four continents, has interviewed economic Nobel Prize winners to try and make sense of the 2008 financial crisis, top Bush administration officials to understand the decision-making process during 9/11, President Obama's top security advisor and the head of the CIA to learn firsthand what went into the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden. Talia has documented street gangs, drug dealers and users, women trafficked in some of the most dangerous places in Central America, former Guantanamo detainees setting out on a new path, and now perhaps the greatest humanitarian crisis of our time, the plight of refugees leaving war-ravaged Syria to seek asylum and safe havens in other countries. Her riveting documentary, Sky and Ground, chronicles the journey of the Nabi clan, a large, extended Syrian Kurdish family, as they painstakingly make their way from virtually decimated Aleppo to the Idomeni refugee camp on the border of Greece and Macedonia, to their goal of Berlin, where they hope to be reunited with other family members and start new lives. Talia grew up in Israel. She moved to the Netherlands, back to Israel, and has a place in London, but has been in New York City for more than 20 years. Okay, Talia, I'm exhausted.
I'm exhausted. Is that me?
Welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Let's go back. Why Talia and film?
So I come to this from the journalism side, and I started in radio when I was 18. I did my army service.
A lance woman.
As a radio reporter, it's so nice to just have a microphone and a headphone so you don't have to deal with the rest. So it's nice to have this atmosphere around. And I started, I really sort of always had this, growing up in Israel means that you always have the radio on. Something may always happen. Growing up in Israel in Jerusalem means that something probably just happened. And so I always had that sensibility, I think. And army service led me to journalism. I came to the U.S. a little bit shortly after. I always wanted to do something visual also. I combine my interest in global politics, international issues with journalism, and I went to work for CNN for about 10 years.
Did you go to college in Israel?
No, I went here. First and second degree, both here.
In
New York.
In journalism?
I did my undergrad studies in Hunter in it's like a weird triple major of media and international politics.
Okay, well, there's a connection for sure.
Yep, and then a master's of international affairs at Columbia, which allowed me to experiment with film a little bit.
Why did you come here, first go round?
The true story?
Yeah.
Things you do at 21. I followed a boyfriend.
Oh, okay.
It was three months.
Yeah,
why not?
Yeah.
20 years later.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I always, you know, fascinated by New York from movies growing up and the opportunities that it offered. I grew up quite creative, dancing and acting. And I always had this idea that maybe New York will be the place where I can get to exercise some of that. But then went into the journalism side.
Which also makes sense to be here.
Yeah, completely. And did 10 years at CNN as a producer, working on some seriously big stories. Not by choice, but having to be there during 9/11, covering Katrina, some very, very big events.
So were you a field producer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So field and studio kind of interchange. I worked on an 8 p.m. primetime show. So whatever was needed.
So you were dancing as fast as you can, I would imagine. That's a very fraught job as you're running from pillar to post.
It is. And you're leaving your, after 9/11, we all learned to have a little bag under the desk because you never know when is the flight you have to catch. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a while. And I think the last 3-4 years there, I started getting a little bit antsy. I wanted to do longer form. I always sort of had this idea that I wanted to tell longer stories. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about journalism is the adrenaline, and you hop from one place to the next. The downside, you just get to connect to a place. You just started getting to know the people, and then they're like, we need you to move on. And the last few years that I was there, I think it was a little bit after Katrina, I started thinking, I want to do something slightly different to really remove myself from the temptation to do something that I know and it's easy. I just picked up and went to London. They have a great history and tradition of documentary filmmaking. I also thought on a practical level, it was a very survivable way of doing documentaries. You don't have to sit at the end of the kitchen table and apply for grants. The BBC is quite an established system. Mm-hmm. And you sort of, and so you can live off making films.
You had no problem getting a job with the BBC.
It took, you know, the first few months, and because of my CNN street cred and having started my career there in financial journalism of all, I landed straight into the financial crisis.
Of 2008?
Yes.
But this is while you're in London?
Just as I got to London. So people were looking for people who could understand what it meant. And I still had, not the Rolodex, but the people that I knew in this. And I couldn't understand it. In all these complex securities.
How did this happen? And, yeah. Uh-huh. With all these checks and balances, in other words.
Which really helped. You know, it was all kind of calling cold of like, yeah, I just worked at CNN. Can you give me a job in documentary? I had to take a step back to prove that I can do these things. Mm-hmm. But then one thing led to the next. And
you proved
after
yourself.
After about a year of financial documentaries, almost 2 years of how did it happen? Why did it happen? Could it happen here again? Can it happen there again? I sort of established myself there.
But these were documentaries for television.
Yes, these were documentaries for television, what they call their current affairs. And then I became, all the financial stuff started dying out. And they said, wait a second, you're the U.S. expert. So I started getting all these calls about films that are taking place in the U.S. And then I realized I miss New York so much.
I got to go back.
So I'm 1 foot here, 1 foot there. I just started, I sort of made it known that I'm back and I'm available. And I wanted to do things here. And I think it started kind of getting to me that making film about the U.S., for the UK, felt a little bit, I'm an insider more than an outsider in New York, for sure. And I didn't like that I had to take a step back and give this sort of outsider perspective, dumb it down a little bit. The Europeans have this thing about looking down at America.
Yeah, holier than thou, huh?
So I wanted to do things where I felt comfortable on the same level. I mean, comfortable and challenging, because then I go and do things about trafficked women in Honduras or a family of refugees from Syria.
So you come to New York as an independent.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to do both. So I tend to work whenever I have some downtime on my own ideas, see where they go. But we all have to live and pay our bills in New York. So I do a lot of TV work where I get hired to make a film about this and that. The channel, the broadcaster had already agreed to finance it.
Sure. What feeds you in terms of your own personal projects? So you do the financial crisis or Osama bin Laden or whatever, but somewhere in your body is germinating an idea that has to get out, that you have to give birth to.
Yes. I think that if you look at the kind of films that I've been making, conflict is very often what they have in common. But with my attempt is to take stories that are the headline types, the things that at CNN you will get the 45 seconds report,
right,
and try to find a human into them. So what interested me in 9/11 was actually, and this is a film that was nominated for BAFTA and other awards, is not to tell the story of what happened, but actually to go inside, to sit with Dick Cheney and get him off script. And hear, was there a moment where he was afraid? Was there a moment where that fear had impact on how he made the next three calls? To talk to people who are caught up in the middle of that. So we know their faces. We know the footage of Giuliani running with his aides. What really was going on in their heads?
Did you honestly think that they were going to take their clothes off for you?
I have this ability to disarm some of them. And I don't know if it's the outsider charm. But, you know, I sort of discovered over the years that I can bring out stuff from people on that level. So the stuff that fascinates me is those big topic stories that we know are important. but I want to get them to the human level.
Right. And so they were honest with you and they opened up to you.
Not everyone.
No,
To the deepest level. But yeah, and the film is, I think what makes it quite interesting is it's full of this like little gossip tidbits that you are just, you know, some of them have rehearsed their stories for years.
Did you humanize Dick Cheney?
You know, there was about 30 seconds. It helped that his wife was in the room. And as controlling and sort of steadfast she seems, when you talk about those moments and how they really felt, you get something slightly different. I got Rumsfeld to tear.
You're sure he didn't have something in his eye?
The production office had this big board, and it was called the Talia Tearmometer. With pictures of all these guys and how good or bad that went in terms of getting the tears. And there were, I mean, some of them just all of a sudden found themselves in, this is for the 10th anniversary, in a very emotional place.
And this was your baby.
It was initially commissioned as a general idea, and I developed the story to be about the inside decision-making.
And who funded you?
So this was a giant co-production at the end because we needed more money.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, sure.
It was the Smithsonian. It was ITV in the UK. It was BBC Worldwide. So this went, I don't know, to how many countries.
Wow.
A lot of people got to see that.
And your credit was
I was the producer of that.
Yeah. So you're doing very fraught topics, but then comes Sky and Ground, which really must be like nothing you've ever done before, even though you certainly were prepared for it on some level. I want to know how you came to make this movie, and then I want you to take us through the process. The process.
So I was sitting in the production company. This was after having spent the entire fall watching, like all of us, watching those streams of people just going through the fields in Europe and just marching and going on those trains and being stuck in train stations and security guards, watching who's coming and who's going to, who is allowed into Europe and who's not, and the boats, and which, you know, really frustrated me. And I was thinking, how do I get to do something about that? Because one of the things for me was that being Jewish with a big part of my family from Eastern Europe, having survived World War II, big part of my family did that 70 years ago, you know, walked through those fields.
So it's a kind of tie that binds in a way.
Very much. And it just, it's so depressing to see that 70 years later, you get another
Everything stream. Old is new again. It seems to be a mantra that I've been saying a lot lately.
Very, very true. And I was looking for a way in, and I sort of heard this talk in the office about a project that they were working on developing, which was called Humanity on the Move. That was meant to be this sweeping project, which will take a look, three different films that would take a look at the refugee crisis around the world.
What year is this?
16. And I just kept volunteering advice. Oh, you want to go and film in Central America? When I was doing this, then just to show my interest.
But that makes sense.
Yes. And then one day they said, if you want to go this refugee camp on the border of Greece and Macedonia, you want to see if you can find anything there. So a day later, I was on my way to Idomeni, sort of reading quickly on the plane, what's the situation at the moment.
And you're going alone?
And I went alone initially. Recruited on the ground or sort of from Europe, two translators.
Who met up with you there?
Yeah. One was an Arabic translator. The other one was a Kurdish translator. So Kurdish and Farsi are quite similar. She could help also with Afghan stories. I just found myself in this refugee camp. There were about 11,000 people there at a time. And this was not an organized refugee camp. It's a bunch of people who got to the border seeing those reports about the other Syrians and Afghans who got to the border and thought they can just continue. But in February of that year, the European countries started sort of renegotiating the terms. And in March, they closed the border. So initially, a lot of these people thought, a couple of days, they'll reopen it.
Yeah.
It's fine. And days and weeks and months passed. And that was it. So there was this giant group that just camped out by the fence.
That had nothing? There was
initially
nobody
nothing.
Supervising
nope.
this, providing?
Nope. Initially, nothing. When we got there, they started getting services. So some of the NGOs started coming in So Doctors Without Borders would set up a clinic. A volunteer group from Spain came with trucks with food. Another volunteer group offered kids something to do. The place was packed with kids and extremely bored kids. They were just running around. These are huge families. And they were all sort of makeshift tents. UNHCR came in eventually and started building some tents. But this is also a place with this really strange microclimate. So you could start a day with 80 degrees and end with 42 and freezing rain.
Good Lord.
And it was just up and down. And the mood was like that because there were rumors.
Yeah.
Oh, they may open the border tomorrow. Should we all go to the border? They all stand by the fence. The soldiers on the other side get nervous. The Greek police turns up just to make sure nothing happens, which causes tension. There were riots. There were fights between families, fights between groups of Kurds and Arabs, between Afghans and Syrians. That place was so chaotic.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what chaos. And you're absorbing all of this.
And trying to find stories.
And how long are you there?
In and out, it was a few weeks. The luxury of filmmaking is that
you get
of
to
the
go
kind
home.
That I mm-hmm. yeah, and I sort of preferred also from the filmmaking perspective, I immerse myself to a point. I don't become a subject. So I go in and I spend enough time with them to understand what they go through. But I don't have the complete same experience. I need to keep a little bit of that distance so I can decide what I want to document.
Sure. I can't imagine, though, that that's something natural to do almost, that you're so absorbed by this, that you wouldn't walking around this place with your mouth open 24/7.
Yeah, and it's a tough decision to make sometimes. You know, as the film progressed, I can talk about that. There were a lot of decisions like that because why am I different? And I want to be part of a solution somehow. Then again, I'm making a film and I'm in an observational role here.
So, non-judgmental too.
Yeah, so I commuted from the luxury of a hotel. But we spent days and nights there and just capturing whatever we could. So I initially went with these two translators.
And it was just the three of you? And yeah. Three women?
Yeah, three brave women. For them, it was easy because they blend in very naturally. One of them was Syrian Kurdish, who just left a year earlier. And the other one was Palestinian Greek. And she did some charity work. So she spent time in Idomeni just weeks before and actually slept in the tents and got to meet a lot of the refugees. And we just walked around to look, looking for stories. And I would hear someone having a fight with a new HCR representative. And I would just try to follow the story and what's going on there. I speak some Arabic.
But you're not shooting. You're just absorbing.
No, just trying to find the story. Mm-hmm. And we had some information through Facebook on people who might be active there, might be worth looking. And that's how I first heard about Guevara. He had a pretty active Facebook page. And this is Guevara, who turned out to be sort of the main character of the story.
Who, and I love the fact that he
called himself
Che Guevara and adopted his name. So you befriended him?
Yep. Asked if we can talk a little bit. I chatted with him just before we got there. And with a very nice Middle Eastern hospitality, it was immediately sit down for dinner. And I got to meet the extended family. They were trying to figure out their way out of there. They were kind of giving up on the hope. There was a little girl there. They didn't want to expose her to the riots and to the tear gas.
You mean to go back home?
No, in Idomeni, the daily life there was not a pretty thing.
I'm sure not.
People were getting sick. And they wanted something. So Guevara said, okay, let's try to get out. And I said, wait, can we tag along? And there was a whole family there. A Kurdish family was sort of deeply rooted socialist values. So everything was decided by committee. So there was a family meeting. And they decided it was okay. As long as I don't endanger them, which was, of course, never my intention, and that they can back off. And that's how we started. I should just add that when I met Guevara, we started talking and he had a camera. I said, what's that? And he told me that he's been documenting his family and his own story since 2011, 12 in Aleppo.
Mm-hmm.
And as a filmmaker, you go like, that could work. So he understood what we are trying to do.
And how long was the family in the camp?
At that point, 2.5 months. So they came, and it was really, really sad. They, three brothers left earlier, so they were pretty comfortable in Germany. One of them had a job. The other one had was studying German. The third one was studying, still just kind of in a refugee camp. The rest sort of weren't sure what they wanted to do until one day the matriarch, the great matriarch, Hajj, as she's called, Jalila, said, we have to go. So they left late and they went to Turkey and they thought they could just be fine in Turkey. But Turkey was very difficult for them. And as Kurds, it was actually harder. And by the time, they weren't very lucky, so they got caught in Turkey, arrested.
There were about 15 of them, right?
The family is about 8. There was another family that joined them on the journey. When they first tried to go from Turkey to Greece, they got caught and sent back on the boat. And good then in God. Greece again. So by the time they got to the border, they said, oh, we'll just wait our turn. The next day, the border was closed.
Oh, good.
So they got stuck. And they were one of these groups that just hoped that it will change. But by the time I met them, they were losing hope in the idea that something, a solution will come from above. So they figured they needed to do something for themselves.
So you go back to London.
Or here, I can remember.
To say, I got my family.
At the time, I worked with two other stories, to be honest. So I was trying to, that's what you do when you develop something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You sort of see what lands. And also you don't know, I mean, if someone just decides, okay, when I'm going to move, I'm just going to stay in a camp. It's a film, but it's a very different film. So I had two other stories that I actually pursued all the way until the summer. One of them was a married couple. And the other one was a group of Afghan boys that I met who are all on their own, ranging between 12 and 18. They just created this like mini camp for themselves. They met there and they kind of fathered each other, which is fascinating to watch. But some of them just disappeared. They went and never came back. Some of them, one guy got caught 42 times trying to make it to make
yeah,
it
to leave. Yeah.
Yeah. And they got beaten up. So still followed those three stories, but the Nabi family was ready to go. So I said, okay, I'm going to try and do this. And we came back. And they were fighting when the GPS wasn't working and the pin wasn't working. So they couldn't leave until their plan was working. And the plan was to take phones and solar chargers and follow an app that helps them, helps everyone in the world who is from the family, direct them to a path that will lead them all the way from the border of Greece and Macedonia to Berlin.
I can't wrap my head around this. How many of you were there?
Initially, too many, I thought, which was Axel Baumann, my cameraman. Mm-hmm. There was a sound guy on the first 3 days. Later, I thought that was not a good idea. And these days, a lot of cinematographers do their own sound. So it was there was a solution to that and a translator. But as this journey progressed, I got more comfortable with my Arabic, which just sort of decided we needed to travel lighter. So at some point, it became just Axel and myself.
Here is this group who is going by foot from a city of 11,000 and GPS notwithstanding, making their way, what, hundreds and hundreds of miles to Germany. It's a reality, but it's so hard to wrap my head around this as I'm watching this in the comfort of my den.
The thing to remember about this, and if you saw the film, there's a lot of dealing with human traffickers. This smuggler will get us here. This one wants 800 euros per person. This one, no one prepared them to deal with that. It's not like you take a course in being a refugee. These are people who left middle-class jobs and education, just functioning in a normal society. And they're moving into this alternative universe where you negotiate the price. Oh, the girl, she's small. She's half a person for the trafficker.
Oh, she get a deal.
Yeah, she get a deal. You get only 600 euros for her.
But how did they even actually get out of the damn camp?
You just go for a walk. And you're carrying a lot. Mm-hmm. And you just keep
and nobody's
walking.
Paying any attention to you for all intents and purposes.
You have to do it. So they snuck out in the evening. Mm-hmm. They separated into little groups. And they tried to not carry too much on them. So it would appear as if they went to just get a little bit of fresh air. And they just kept walking.
How long did you document this?
So they set off in May.
Of 2016.
In 2016. And I finished filming with them in November of 2016. So about 6 months.
How stunning was the contrast for you. That on so many levels, Talia, you're Israeli, number one. You're female, number two. You're free, number three. I mean, I could just go on and on. I understand this film is not about you, but it's about you.
This definitely gives you a reason to say, thank you for everything I have. I will stop kvetching about the MTA and the subways not working. And it's kind of rainy today. It definitely gives you a perspective. And the thing that is really hard, you know, there were kids. Part of the family was under 18. And then the most direct and innocent. And they would go like, why do you get to go back to the hotel?
Where was your hotel? Where did you go?
So we were just along the way, whatever we could find. In terms of the production management, we just figured it out as we went.
But you're surreptitiously making your way somewhere so that you're not discovered. And I mean, so you're in a car and you can...
So we would take a local driver, mm-hmm. usually a local car, so we don't stick out. Mm-hmm. We got stopped, detained at one point, threatened many times, but never with them. So we would sort of arrange with them via WhatsApp when is a good time to try and meet up, because we knew the general area where they were at. We would drive there, and this was a few times a day or in the middle of the night, but whenever worked for their journey. We would get dropped off somewhere and then just walk in the fields towards a location they would send us via WhatsApp to meet up, and then just sit down and film with them for a few hours or walk with them for a few hours until they thought it was time to do something else, or we thought we had what we needed.
Were they the only ones, in a sense, on their route?
Not at all. There's a moment in the film when they decide to leave. It's like this week of frustration in the camp. And you can just feel the tension. So a lot of families were like, we're out of here before something really bad is happening. So they finally get the GPS to work and they start walking. And then he looks and there's this like snaking line of people leaving the camp. Everyone is trying to sort of sneak out. And his idea was, Guevara's idea was, well, if they get caught, then I can get away. So they waited a bit and kept going.
Always thinking. You know,
always
thinking.
But he was not prepared for that. You know, he was a bit of an activist in Aleppo, but then finding himself in this role.
Well, how do you prepare yourself for that?
Exactly.
I wonder when you say you don't inject yourself into mm-hmm. stories too, but was there some kind of a contrast of feeling that these were your family members?
Oh, definitely. So I'm Israeli, which is very different, but not that different. Mm-hmm. We're neighbors.
Yeah.
And I grew up, my grandmother was born and raised in Jerusalem. Her best friend was from Aleppo. So I grew up with that food and that sort of hospitality. I called her auntie. I remember when Axel, who was brought up here and in Europe, was not sort of used to the Middle Eastern hospitality. So I knew there's no way we can turn the camera on before we sat and ate something. And he would say, get out of the shot, get out of the shot. But it doesn't work. He would not get to turn on his camera. He needs to eat too.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways it was sort of, yeah, I actually just want to sit and have a chat with them and some food. Mm-hmm. Are we still making this
beyond
film?
The fact that you yeah. were a director? I mean, not on the professional level, but on the human level.
Completely. And I love this family. And one of the reasons I chose to go with that story. So there was Guevara making the film. There was the films and the tapes from the years before. There was the fact that there were three generations, and that was sort of interesting in itself. But more than anything, I just love them. And I love their little bickering,
mm-hmm.
family bickering, just like, take out this, take out the trash. I told you to wash the dishes. Why is he doing this?
It didn't matter that they're living in the woods somewhere?
I loved it. Yeah, and it was so normal. And I just felt, you know, a lot of the back and forth sounded like, oh, God, that sounds like every family I know. And the fact that they managed to keep that normalcy rather than sit there. And there were people who were, I mean, there were suicide attempts in the camps. There were a lot of horrible things. But they managed to keep, and they, at night, they would all, Guevara had managed to sneak in all the way from Syria, his computer, and they would all gather around his laptop and listen to traditional music. And occasionally dance. And it was, I mean, some of this didn't make it to the film because they were quite embarrassed about that. But there was something just so human and dignified and mm-hmm. just normal. And that's what I wanted people to see. There is a refugee story that we hear about, and it's sort of top down. And you look at them, they all kind of look miserable in the same way. And this was an attempt to just show them on the same level as us.
Humanize them.
They have faces. They have things. They have dreams that they left behind. There's a moment in the film, Hiba was the oldest daughter, who's 21. When Guevara gets arrested, spoiler alert, she just stands there and she doesn't know what to do. And she's like, what? I should have just stayed in Aleppo. At least, you know, I would have my life. I had dreams. What is this life? I had, my life has gone to nothing in those months. I remember nothing. Nobody thinks of me as anything. For them, I'm just another card. And she's 21, and you can see this sort of very serious frustration. And they learn in that such a young age so much about the world, you know. Way too young.
I don't want to talk about the end of the film because I think people should see it. But I want to know why you call it Sky and Ground.
It's funny. We went through a few ideas. Who is this? Is it Guevara's film? Is it about the experience? And there was something that I kept asking them at every junction. So the way we worked is we were observational. And we would kind of try to be fly on the wall and just film them as they were going along the journey. And then I would isolate some of them, mostly Guevara, for interviews to talk about what they've been through over the last 24 hours or 48 hours. And there was a question I kept asking, so what is home? Because sometimes on the hills of Macedonia and what they called the jungle, the woods, Idomeni started feeling like home. Why did we leave our home in the refugee camp?
Right.
And it's always sort of this place you don't have or you are going into. So
of course.
That question, Sky and Ground, is an answer at one point to that question.
How do you feel about the film?
We just had the world premiere and it was the first time I got to see it on a really big screen.
With other people?
With a lot of other people. And a lot of friends and people who knew about the process but never got to see it put together. And that was a unique experience to just feel in the audience.
That sounds to me, Talia, like an understatement.
But there are moments that you just don't know if they work until you hear their jokes. Mm-hmm. I mean, we still kept light moments with that teasing each other or, you know, they sort of tease us or tease the camera. And I was just nervous. I wasn't sure if people would get it. I didn't want it to be just a downer. And there are moments where I, for the millionth time that I'll watch it, I'll be like almost tearing up. So I wanted to see if those worked. But then after we had a Q&A session and some of the questions were so moving and just made me kind of go back to that experience. I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to do it and to contribute something. To this day, they're so modest and they say, well, you know that we're only one story. And that's how I feel. I contributed one story to telling this big story of this crisis, which is the biggest thing the world is
ever going
through.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you tell even one story, and it's one of hundreds of thousands, and somehow I ended up getting matched up with theirs.
A beshared moment meant to be.
Yeah.
You know, I interviewed a woman named Nicole Tung, who's a photojournalist and did a lot of shots in Syria and said that there are just days that she sort of feels that nobody gives a damn, you know, that she's taking all these pictures. And yes, so what?
There is definitely fatigue, I think, in the general sort of public.
Zeitgeist of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, we've seen this again, refugees. Oh.
Yeah.
Syria, yeah, we know. I mean, that's probably why it's important to keep trying. This film struggled for a while with getting the financing and getting to be shown on screens. As a filmmaker, it's quite funny to have, I was talking to a friend last night. So I make films that are getting watched by millions on TV. But yet, having... standing in front of an audience of 300 people who just watched it was such a different experience.
Oh, I bet. I bet.
It's more immediate and it's really gratifying and sort of, you know, healthy in terms of the feedback. My boyfriend is an actor, so I guess he gets to do that on stage every night, but I don't. And I sort of send those final cuts to, you know, TV to screen and that's it. Like sometimes someone... I caught it here, I caught it there, or I read the review. But there's such a difference in getting to real people and standing next to them and seeing that telling this one little story maybe made a difference. And people did bother to come, even though there's this fatigue. Afterwards, we had all these people approaching us and they want to put it in other festivals. And when is the PBS date? And is it going to go to Europe? And I'm really hoping that this film, because of what it covers and because of how it shows refugees, will have a longer life.
This should be required viewing. I don't think that there's a discussion about that.
It's great to hear.
We're running out of time, but you got other things up your sleeve?
Yeah, so there's things I can talk about. I finished a film very recently that also involved partly refugees. It was hosted by Christiane Amanpour from CNN.
Sure.
It will run on CNN in early 2018, mm-hmm. and it mostly covers Germany. It's called Amanpour and Sex and Love, and we talked to refugees about their experiences.
And coming to Europe and settling there.
And dealing with the sort of differences and the cultural differences.
Must be massive.
So there are some great moments there. She's amazing to work with. Mm-hmm. And there's something that I can talk about, but that's my next thing. It has to do with Israel. Mm-hmm. And actually coming back home a little bit and dealing with a story that is connected to Holocaust survivors who sort of fresh off the boat turn up in 48 in Israel and join the independence fight of 48 and what happened to them. So it's as much as I can say about that.
That's fine, because we'll just have you back.
Great.
You know,
I'd love to.
It's just such an honor and a privilege to meet women like you, and how grateful we are for what you do. I know that may sound kind of lofty and, oh, Sandy, come on, but I sincerely mean it. I'm in awe, and thank you.
Thanks very much for having me. It was great.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.